favourites today, I just need to say Blams, Front Lawn, Mutton Birds. His name is Don McGlashan, and he joins me now. Hello.
Hi, Kim, how are you?
How would you like to be introduced, I wonder? Because everybody goes, oh, Blams, Front Lawn, Mutton Birds, Don McGlashan, Anchorman. How would you, what would you like your non-posthumous obituary to sound like?
It's a little early for that, isn't it?
I know, I just thought I'd hit you below ground first.
That's okay. I mean, Blams, Front Lawn, Mutton Birds, it's okay.
That's
okay.
All right. If you were on a desert island, which of the many instruments that you were able to play would you want with you?
I think the euphonium, I could probably make some sort of water distillation plant out of it.
Oh.
Probably. I mean, a guitar would probably get eaten by, by tropical ants or something.
The euphonium.
And there's not much point in having anything electric, is there?
No.
It's a real desert island.
Precisely.
I think the euphonium's got a...
And percussion, you can always make something up.
Well, yeah, I could probably... I could kill a turtle or something.
Yeah.
But no, I think the euphonium's got raw materials that I could recycle.
You have a choice, of course, I should tell people, of what? The cornet, the cello, the piano, the euphonium, the trumpet, percussion, flute, saxophone, French horn. Anything missed out there?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't play any of them that well.
Oh, what?
I think the euphonium is actually probably my favourite one because it's kind of a poor man's French horn, and I always kind of wanted to be a French horn player.
And so what, do you start off with a euphonium like you start off with a recorder or something?
No, what happened was I played the French horn in an orchestra for a while, and then I realised that with the French horn you practice for 3 hours a day to stay the same in terms of quality, and if you want to get better, you have to practice for 5 hours a day. And I didn't have 5 hours in my day.
You mean you do 3 hours so that you don't start deteriorating?
Yeah, it's terrible. It's a really unforgiving instrument. So that,
why?
Just because it's so hard.
Why is it so hard?
I think it's badly designed. It's a design fault.
But it's hung around for a fair few centuries now, hasn't it?
Oh, well, lots of bad ideas have hung around for a few centuries.
Because I always thought that trombone looked a bit unwieldy myself. Makes a great noise, but, you know, there must be easy ways to make that noise, don't you think?
To make the noise that the trombone makes?
Yeah.
Well, I've been just thinking about what sort of noise a Patagonian toothfish might make.
When it's being poached or not?
I'm a bit worried about it. I think I'll dream about Patagonian toothfish tonight.
It
sounds like something Bruce Chatwin would have written about.
Yeah, and it sounds incredibly unpalatable.
Are you really going to talk about eating it next week?
No.
Oh, okay.
Stupid. Where would I get a Patagonian toothfish from? It's not something you can go down to the fishmongers and ask for these days.
Wellington's a pretty cosmopolitan place, I hear.
But, yeah, but not that cosmopolitan, I don't think, unless one falls off the back of a truck. A poached Patagonian toothfish.
Dixon Street Deli, I reckon.
Well, that's right. More Wilson, whatever. All right, what is your proudest moment in your whole career? I'm not talking about, you know, childbirth or anything, but whole career. Career proudest moment.
Wow. I think getting to England and hearing a Mutton Birds song on Virgin Radio, I think was probably well, we were in a taxi cab, and I think and the taxi driver sort of turned around and said, oh, I like this one.
No.
And
you just arrived.
Yeah, it had been playing. I mean, we'd had a few songs being played already, but it was just this wonderful moment.
And he had, did you tell him who you were?
No, we were quite sort of shy about it. But I think that was the best thing. And there were other things too. I think one time when the Front Lawn was in New York, and we just opened a run at the Dance Theatre Workshop, and we got a rave review in the New York Times. And I'd lived in New York before, and I'd sort of travelled on the subways and you know, read the New York Times in the subway. And this time, my name was in it. And I sort of, I wanted to jump up and down and wave it in everybody's face.
Have you got that framed anywhere?
Or
do you not do that?
No, I don't.
You had to think about it for a moment, no?
Yes, I did.
Do you wish you did do that?
Now
you've got children, you know.
Yeah, hopefully they will frame.
Oh, you can't rely
like
on that.
Significant sort
no,
of things
no,
in my
no,
history.
No, you can't rely on that.
No.
You'll do it for them, but it's unlikely that they'll do it for you.
Oh, it's not reciprocal. Oh, no. Well, I'll work on them. I'll have a talk with them tonight about that.
The first the first track you've chosen is Billie Holiday's Gloomy Sunday.
Yeah, yeah, it's a... I was trying to work out why I chose it. It's just this beautiful tune, I think. And also, I've always really loved songs where there's a kind of mystery about who the singer is. All those old country songs where the singer might be dead or the singer might be a ghost or something like that. And there's bits of that in this song because you're not sure whether her lover's died or has just gone away or maybe she's dead and he's alive. It's got a lot of mystery in it. And also there's those wonderful rhymes, those wonderful numberless and slumberless and haunted you and wanted you. It's just a beautiful song.
Nobody sounds like Billie Holiday, does she?
Yes.
Do they? Gloomy Sunday. Chris Burke was just telling me there's a film during the rounds called Gloomy Sunday, which is about that song, and I've been completely unaware of this. Did you know that?
No.
Oh, well, there you are, you see. It's all about it having an unfortunate effect on people. It's about the person who wrote it. And it's showing at a theatre near you. Furthermore, you can get Patagonian toothfish.
Somebody
you can
just
buy it.
Yeah.
You can buy it in specialist
stores. What a job
stores.
You have.
I know. I'm here to tell you, you can buy Patagonian toothfish in certain places of delicatessen flavour.
Do you have to take the teeth out before you can cook
well,
it?
Well, quite so.
Or are the teeth part
well,
of
how
the
would you chew it otherwise, Dawn?
No, not your teeth.
Oh, not my teeth. I think that if something's got to the trouble of being a Patagonian toothfish, it deserves not to die, personally. Because it can't be that easy being a Patagonian toothfish. Where did you go when you first went overseas, very first time?
I was in a youth orchestra and I went to Sydney. I think we toured up and down the east coast of Australia. No Patagonian toothfish there.
No. As you do, I suppose. Australia is always the first...
Yeah, but I was so despondent about my French horn playing. It's sort of that I ended up selling my French horn in Sydney and coming back without one and having to do the final concert in Auckland on a borrowed instrument. It was
really?
Sort of dramatic teenage sort of
but you did a
nasty
whole
thing to do.
University diploma in French horn.
Yeah, but I wasn't very good at it. And as I said before, I just kind of didn't have the stickability or the... sort of rigorousness to practice the damn thing. And also I really wanted to write stuff. Probably the biggest influence on me was going to American poetry classes, and Winston Kernow and Roger Horrocks made me start a journal.
Yeah.
And I've kept that habit up for the, you know, since then really. When I was about 16 I started that. And that really got me into wanting to write more and more songs. And about that time the punk era was starting. I'd already been in bands. And I got into my first band, which was sort of loosely speaking a punk band.
And what was that called?
Well, it was called The Plague. I was playing in an orchestra, so I was turning up at Plague concerts, having been playing Shostakovich and Mahler and stuff. And I'd have my penguin suit on, and I'd play French horn at the back of the Plague, who used to play in really sweaty, dingy dives in Parnell. And quite often the whole front line of that band would be naked and painted different colours.
And you were in the back in your suit playing the French horn?
Yeah. I kept my whole suit on for each performance.
They would have thought you were very cool indeed, I suppose.
I'm not sure, actually. I think they were too busy trying to dodge projectiles.
See, the thing I've always thought about your career, in an unverbal way, it's only just come to me, is that you've never... tried to do anything that anybody else has done before in a sort of automatic way. You've just done what you wanted to do and discovered that other people liked it. Is that a kind of obvious thing to say?
I don't know. I was thinking of that, and I was thinking of this thing I'm just heading off on now, which is the solo shows I'm about to do, and trying to work out what the motivation is behind putting together a little group with guitar and accordion and loops. And I guess it's a front lawny thing. I guess it is that approach of let's make a film. First question, how does everybody else do it? Second, conclusion, let's not do it that way.
Yeah.
And I guess that I don't know whether that's always been a part of my career. In some ways, the Mutton Birds was quite a conservative thing, but
doesn't sound like it though. I mean, it still sounds wild to listen to now. In many ways,
I've never heard that word used in a sentence about the Mutton Birds.
Yeah. By which I mean unusual.
Oh yeah, I think we're great.
Strange.
But certainly, certainly it was around that time when everybody was around that time in the early 90s when everybody was doing getting into electronic stuff to form quite a sort of a basic band, which some people in England called it folk rock when we arrived there, which I thought was a bit cruel.
I don't know.
But I mean, it was. I suppose it was going against the flow of the tide.
I don't know. What would you call it?
Oh, I'm terrible at those sort of things.
It's like so and so mix, something like that. Yeah. Folk rock? No, not quite right. No, I can imagine they had trouble categorising it. I mean, I suppose that's the charm of it, isn't it? How would you categorise Front Lawn?
Oh, that would be quite difficult. That'd be quite difficult. But musically, certainly this where I'm going now is, I suppose it's going back a little way to that kind of emptiness and minimalism and storytelling in songs.
Mm.
Certainly, the songs are getting longer. I'm not going to be giving any. I'm not. You know, those record company people who say I don't hear a single when they listen to an album of demos, are they going to? They're going to have a field day.
They're not even going to hear a whole CD. second track, Buzzcocks. Who are the Buzzcocks?
Yeah, what, you like the Buzzcocks?
I don't. I've never heard of the Buzzcocks.
Oh, where have you been?
I know. I'm sheltered.
When I first was trying to play the drums in Blam Blam Blam, I hadn't really been a drummer. I'd learnt how to play, I think, snare drum in a brass band when I was a kid. But I locked myself away with this record and... I just love the simplicity of it and the honesty of the lyrics, because a lot of that punk stuff that was happening around then was kind of veiled or ironic or hiding behind some kind of pose or something, and I love that energy, but I could connect with these lyrics because it just sounded like they came straight from Pete Shelley's heart, and I just wanted to write songs like that. Of course, I didn't for years and years. It took me years to work out how to write songs from the heart without it sounding like a greeting card, but... I love this stuff.
Well, when did you start writing words?
Probably back when I was about 13, 14.
Have you still got any of those ones?
Yeah. I don't think they'll ever see the light of day, though. But just keeping a journal and trying to write in it every day makes you realise that there's only a few things that you're writing about. I've probably only got about two or three songs in me, and I'm just reworking that material.
There's nothing new to say.
I'm not going to keep writing lots and lots of songs, but it's nice to look back through journals and just find things that actually pre-echo things which I thought were entirely new ideas that came to me sort of yesterday, you know.
Mm. Did you lose, you were, when you went to America for the first time,
yep.
You started writing a lot there, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
And then you lost them all on the ferry?
I lost a whole bag full of stuff. I do that regularly. It must be some sort of...
shedding principle.
Shedding an old skin or something like that. But I'm quite a forgetful, absent-minded person, so I do tend to leave sort of property about, and I think probably there's enough. I've left enough journals full of songs around for quite a few albums to be made. So, and hopefully somebody's actually found them and made the albums, and one day they'll send them to me.
Yeah. Do you think?
Hopefully they're English language. You know, hopefully they haven't been made into sort of Hispanic albums or Croatian albums.
That you'll never be able to understand. Have you lost big lumps of stuff before?
Yeah, we lost a whole, Harry and I lost a whole Front Lawn show once.
Oh.
It got, I left my bag somewhere and it got stolen.
That's
and then,
right.
And then street kids took the credit cards out and went off to discover that there wasn't any money in them. And then
that was a filthy trick to play.
Yeah, yeah. And then looked at this sort of, this journal full of mad scratchings. And we had to go to Sydney and perform a few days later, so we just sat down and tried to write it all from memory, and it came out quite different. It was probably really good, probably a really good process for that show to go through. It was a show called The Story of Robert, which was the one we did after The Reason for Breakfast. It was about a party in Oamaru.
Had you been to a party in Oamaru at that point in your life?
I had, actually. Ah. Yeah, I had.
So it was a real story.
Yeah.
Mm. Also in New York, you worked for the Laura Dean Dance Company.
Yeah.
As what? A musician?
Yeah. Laura had been part of that minimalism movement, sort of loosely. I mean, she'd been linked with, she'd married, actually, to Steve Reich. Quite linked.
It's a serious link.
And so she'd written music which sort of fitted within that kind of box of repetitive kind of stuff, and just as I arrived in New York, she was really
Did you know her?
No, but she'd been to New Zealand and done workshops, and I'd come into one of those workshops as a musician, so I knew some of the people in the company,
uh-huh.
and when I arrived, she'd had a sheltered upbringing too, but she headed off onto a sort of wild path of new discoveries and had choreographed a Peter Gabriel stage show and choreographed a David Bowie video clip, and suddenly she was all excited about rock and roll and she wanted to have rock drums in her dance company. And I just arrived at the right time. I sort of turned up and said, "I've come from New Zealand, can I watch what you do?" And she said, "Yeah, I've been, you know, here's the drumsticks, go over there and play." So I ended up touring with them for a whole year, and did a European tour and did a 2-week season at Sadler's Wells. And
was that wonderful?
Yeah, it was fantastic, actually. But it also taught me that that year in New York also taught me that I needed to be back here and I needed to be doing my own stuff. So I probably could have stayed there, being Mr. Minimal Drummer.
Forever.
Because I was really, you know, I'd worked with Limbs in New Zealand, and so I loved working with dance, and I loved composing for dance. But more and more, I realised that I needed to focus in on what I had to say, and that was part of the motivation for coming back and getting together with Harry and working on the Front Lawn.
It must have felt quite trepidatious to come back.
Yeah, it felt a bit foolish, actually.
People say, "Oh, why? If you're doing well in New York, what are you coming back here for?"
Yeah, what's that paradox about this place? People say it's the best place in the world, and then in the same breath they say, "So, you know, why did you come back?"
Yeah.
And I think living in that paradox is what we have to do. That's our job, really.
Mm. How do you feel about New Zealand now? Given that we accept there is a certain amount of depression here from time to time.
It's taken me a long time to adjust coming back, and I've had my head down, keeping the home fires burning and getting us stable. But I don't think there's anywhere where you can do what I do, you know, sort of write and live.
You've been back for how long now?
It's early 1999, 4 years, is it?
Yeah, yeah. Nearly 4 years.
Yeah, but I think when you come back, you've got to really forgive yourself a long period of adjustment. And
what is it that you have to adjust to mainly?
The other people, I think.
Damn it!
I think you just have to adjust to the way people are here, and
do you like to categorize
and
them?
The distance, the distance that we feel from the rest of the world. I think you have to. Both things are true. It's a wonderful place. It's a wonderful place to live, and it's also a very long way away from the rest of the world.
Mm.
And that makes us all a little odd.
A little odd.
Mm.
Which, of course, is a very good thing, and most of your work wouldn't exist. Certainly the Front Lawn stuff wouldn't exist if we weren't a little
were
odd.
Were we not a little odd? Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Bressa Creating Cake, Rocky Mountain. It's amazing the number of people. Not amazing, but it is remarkable. Worthy of remark, as Max would say. That how many people choose Bressa Creating Cake in their list of favourite songs?
Yeah, but would Max? That's the question.
I don't know.
But
Max is here in person today, and so I will ask him.
Yeah, do that. Speaking of, this is really odd. I mean, this is made by some genuinely odd people, and I don't got no idea what it's about. The lyrics are full of these loopy non sequiturs, and there's melodic things going on that don't have any kind of musical reason for being there. But the whole thing works beautifully, I think.
Bressa Creating Cake, Rocky Mountain, which is off an album called just Breath of
That's
Christian
the only one they made. They broke
only
up.
Only one album.
They broke up. And Ed McWilliams is making records, and he's a genius. And
he worked on the Rain soundtrack.
He did, yeah, he did. And
wasn't that an amazing film?
Yeah, I didn't see it.
Ugh.
Didn't see it.
It's like, did you see, what's that really depressing film? The American film, you know, and it's cold, and it's the family, and it's the 70s, and it's...
Ice Storm! Ang Lee.
It's like, yeah, Ang Lee. It's the same, it gives you the same feeling. You think, my God. Childhood. Ghastliness. Anyway, it's good. I mean, I don't know why ghastliness should be good, but it was at the time. Anyway, sorry, I interrupted you, Jeff.
Yeah. I was just going to drop another name. Jeff Maddox, who's in Golden Horse. And he was another member of Brisa Cream Cake. So they've gone on to other bands, but that was a wonderful record they made. And they've got more wonderful records in them, I'm sure.
I need to tell you that Patagonian Toothfish is...
It's going to run, that, isn't it?
$40 a kilo.
Oh, it's a bit steep for me.
$40 a kilo, just like Orange Ruffy. And they do take the teeth of the fish out.
Good.
But on the grounds that people shouldn't be encouraged to buy it, still less, eat it, I'm not going to tell them where to get it.
Well, it's probably endangered.
Well, precisely.
Yeah.
I mean, you know... For heaven's sake. Why should people... this eternal search for novelty, I feel. You know, what's the matter with lemon fish? There's plenty of lemon fish around that people should be eating, and fish is fish after all, don't you think?
I think the eternal search for novelty is quite... I mean, I've got a vested interest in that because, I come from this really exotic country and I'd quite like music lovers the world over to, buy my records as part of their eternal search for novelty.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Give me a bit of an itinerary, like when are you appearing next?
20th of September at the St. James. It's the first time I'll be playing in Auckland under my own name, and I'm going to go off and do that from now on until that's the end of me.
I was desperately trying to play your Gillian. Is it Gillian Welsh or Gillian Welsh?
I don't know. I think it's...
You are the deciding vote because Chris and I have been arguing about this all morning.
No, I heard somebody call her Gillian Welch, and there was a radio journalist in London who used to insist on referring to the Gallagher brothers as the Gallagher brothers, as if that made him part of some inner circle.
Ah.
And I think it's like that. With
one wouldn't Gillian want to be Welch. Pretentious about this.
Yeah, let's just call her Gillian Welch.
We're not going to play it. Cut the long story short. We've been talking about the Patagonian Toothfish. No, but we'll play it later in the program on account of the fact that, you see... I've been listening to her latest album in the car,
yeah.
And there's a track on it called Miss Ohio. Do you know that one?
No.
Oh, Miss Ohio, driving along with your soft top down or whatever it is. And the dog, it's the only piece of music in the world that the dog sings to. And I wanted to see if...
Is the dog actually on the record or is it your dog?
My dog.
Oh, right, sorry.
And on account of the dog being...
That up.
The dog is here with me now, so we will play it later in the program and we'll see if the dog sings along to it.
Great.
In the meantime, best of luck with your tour.
Thanks a lot.
Nice to talk to you. Don McGlashan